And we're back. Yeah, I know. I promised you 3 episodes last week, and again, we lied to you, but, you know, and I'm sorry. But we're here now. Filmly Feud, Part 3, 2001. Director, you are here. Last episode, last part, Part 3 of our 2001 Best Director Series. Going to give into David Lynch and Mulholland Drive, or How I Learned to Stop Thinking and Let My Brain Turn Itself into Mush. And that's exactly what this movie is. If you haven't seen it, this is a must-see movie. I think it's my highest-rated movie ever, my highest-graded movie ever. I know Mike's also very high on it. If I can get that sentence out, it'd be good. Just to catch you up a couple things before we dive right into this. Don't want to take too much time. But yeah, like I said, we promised you all 3 2001 episodes last week. We're obviously finishing this one off, give you a fresh start to the week on this Monday, get you headlong into Thanksgiving week, started on a good note. So that's one. Two, I promise you, this time, for real, we're giving you, you can mark down on your calendars what the next episode is going to be, and I swear we're going to stick to it. We're going to be doing a Netflix year in review, so that's going to be coming out Wednesday, day before Thanksgiving. I know a lot of you are going to be traveling back home, whether that's you have a long commute by car, plane, train, bicycle, walk, run, whatever you do. We're going to give you a couple hours worth of content so you can kill some time and know what to go through, whether you're Netflix and chilling with your old high school sweetheart or your current day sweetheart. Maybe you're bored at the parents' home. Maybe you're with a bunch of friends from high school or all home for the holiday. You don't know what to do. We're going to give you a glimpse and let you know our thoughts on what Netflix has released this year and on the whole and what's worth getting into, what's worth your time and what isn't. And whatever we think a movie strikes a chord with the Academy, we're going to give you some insight into that as well. 2 quick notes before we start this episode. Number one, Hollywood continues to evolve and reveal itself to be that cesspool that we all kind of knew it was in the back of our heads, and all our heroes are garbage. Obviously, the Louis C.K. news came out about him masturbating in front of a couple female comedians. All of the sexual harassment news is going to be something we touch on in the beginning of the Netflix pod. That's going to be one of our leading topics because Mike and I are going to kind of record that tomorrow, which is Tuesday, and release it Wednesday. So we're going to be more on track with it, going to be more current and up to date. So rather than try to delve into it now, but we do mention in this episode that David Lynch did have a cameo on the show Louis. Just want to get that out there. Obviously, we don't approve of what Louis did or any of the stories about it. And this was recorded prior to Louis, that news coming to light and anyone knowing about it outside of the victims. Same as with the Weinstein stuff when we made quick comment on it. We're on the victim side here. We do not approve of Louis C.K. What he did is vile and disgusting. And that's really all you can say about it. And if anything happens like this in your life or anyone near you, it's important to listen to the victims if they're willing to tell their stories. And if they're not willing to talk yet and not willing, ready to talk or tell their stories, just be there and support them and have their back. So that's all you can do in this situation. That's what makes you a good person. And more than anything, these people need their friends by their sides in their time of need, just like you would want the same to happen to you. The second topic I need to cover is that we're going to be talking about a guy or a girl, I don't know who it is, a person who goes by the moniker Film Critic Hulk. They were with a movie website called Birth Movies Death. Again, because we can't have nice things in this world, Birth Movies Death underwent some turmoil of its own recently. One of its head editors was caught in a sexual harassment dispute. So I don't know if that led to the reason that Film Critic Hulk left, but Film Critic Hulk is no longer with Birth Movies Death. Wanted to get that out there because I do say in the podcast that they are part of Birth Movies Death because the instrument, they were very instrumental in forming my view on Mulholland Drive. I actually read their article that is on Birth Movies Death piece by piece, along with a reviewing of Mulholland Drive in preparation for this podcast. Many, like probably a lot of you, the first time I watched Mulholland Drive, just going in cold, I didn't know what to expect. I was angered and confused by what I saw, but that's part of Lynch's what mayhem and masterpiece. Film Critic Hulk, definitely worth a follow on Twitter. We're going to shout him or her out a couple times throughout the episode, so I just want to give you their Twitter account. It is FILM, as in Mike. Crit, C-R-I-T, Hulk, as in the Marvel superhero. Great follow on Twitter. They wrote the definitive piece, at least in my views, on Mulholland Drive that we referenced. Film Crit, Hulk Smash, Hulk versus the genius of Mulholland Drive. Wanted to get that out there. Definitely follow Film Critic Hulk. We're going to try to post a link to their Twitter when we post this on Twitter on Monday. And definitely give them a follow. But other than those 2 things, let's get into it. Part 3! You made it! You're at the end. David Lynch, 2001 Best Director episode for Mulholland Drive. You know what to do. Comments, questions, get to us. Facebook and Instagram, MikeMikeAndOscar.com. On Twitter at MMO_pod. Gmail, MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com. 2001 David Lynch. Let's do it. We're not going to tell you which one's number two or which one's, which one's number one as far as perfecting perfection goes. We're going to save that till the end. So if you're still with us, we're going to dive now into the David Lynch masterpiece, one of my favorite, if not my favorite movie of all time, Mulholland Drive, David Lynch with the Elvis hairdo. What do we got?
Born in 1946 in Missoula, Montana.
Of course.
Which I'm trying very hard not to pronounce in an Elvis voice. This is a town where I picture every girl in a 1950s ponytail and every guy with a David Lynch haircut.
Just like Bronsonville from The Simpsons.
Yeah. This is...
This ain't over.
The quintessential American town. David Lynch's haircut is immaculate, by the way.
Beautiful.
I want to put that out.
Coiffed.
Even at 71 years old. I don't know how he does it. I mean, my hair is a wannabe.
You don't see any hair plugs there, do you, Michael?
No, not at all. That is very real. And it even does the whoosh over the balding spots.
And that's the professional term for it.
Yes. Lynch grew up in the suburbs and was an art school student in his college years.
Sure was.
He was a visual artist. Who becomes a art filmmaker, making short films one after another.
Nobody ever made any sense over, so they just gave him Bs.
And then then is financed somehow for his long-form art film, the Kafka-esque Eraserhead, which is a trip. Even today, rewatching that baby. Apparently, Lynch conceives his opening shots of Blue Velvet, which essentially launches the rest of his career while he's in art school. Which is, and tells you all you need to know about him, I think, utopian suburbia, shots of utopian suburbia, the grass, the sprinklers.
Everything over the, is the, not always as
the doo-wop
seems,
music.
Michael.
Zoom in on into the blades of grass. Ants warring with one another, killing each other savagely. And that is the opening of Blue Velvet. That is essentially the launch of his...
The layers of
Peaks,
humans
while
and
all
complexity.
His movies, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the hidden violence and nightmare of real life. So his filmography, jump right into that. The Elephant Man and Dune come after Blue Velvet. You know, The Elephant Man is nominated. Blue Velvet is a critical success. Wild at Heart was another movie that really pushed some buttons and, you know, as an art film is quite intense. Of an experience there. You have Twin Peaks from the 90s, where he becomes
Mindfuck.
A cult leader, I think, for all of us. And the Fire Walk With Me movie explains a lot of the return plot lines. So
yeah, he only made you wait 25 years.
I rewatched some of the Fire Walk With Me, even though I will say, to me, his stuff has some diminishing returns. And I was really glad to go back to this one because it kind of made me fall in love with his movies again. Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive, Inland Empire, to me are a trilogy in terms of their structure and style. I don't know how to exactly make them a one-to-one comparison, but they have similarities. Let's say the protagonist, and this is spoiler territory again, folks, the protagonist literally changes identities at the middle point or the two-thirds point of each one of these movies. Yeah, so, I mean, he's also a musician. He's also a self-help book author. He is a transcendentalist.
And yep!
He teaches transcendental meditation.
I could have told you that without knowing it for a fact.
Obviously, he uses surrealism and dream states in his movies.
Sure does.
Politically, he's had some wild transitions in his life. He began as a small government advocate, but has endorsed Barack Obama and Bernie Sanders in the last two elections. So most people turn more conservative as they
if
age.
He was a stand-up comedian, he would be an absurdist.
He's done
in the, that he just likes keeping people on his toes.
He's done the opposite of most human arcs.
He's a crazy person.
he has a cameo in Louis' show.
Some
on
of
FX.
The best scenes in some of the best cameos in TV history.
I mean, he's the coach for the late night talk
outstanding.
Show host.
Outstanding, just outstanding.
His first lesson for Louis C.K. is just how to take imaginary applause. This is like the perfect David Lynch scene. Like, if you're going to have David Lynch in your comedy show, Louis just has him, you know,
giving out absurd directions.
Taking imaginary applause is just brilliant. Okay, the nexus of films, derivatives, influences on his work that kind of make that form Mulholland Drive that I've seen alluded to are Ingmar Bergman's Persona, 1950s Sunset Boulevard, and All About Eve is kind of something that I jump off to.
Listen to the 1950 Best Actress pod we have for you.
Yeah, Chinatown, 1974. So this is, it makes this kind of a natural progression for us in terms of, you know, podcasts. Gilda, I've never seen, but everybody else says The Wizard of Oz. So I don't know if that will pop up.
Yeah, just because they think he's a flying monkey.
Yeah. So that's a crazy nexus.
It's just a crazy man.
Out of all the nexuses, nexuses. So that's a wild one, and I'm excited to get into this. This is quite the movie.
Let's dive. Mulholland Drive, written and directed by David Lynch, and if he's writing something, you know what's going to happen. It was first released on May 16th in Cannes. The film festival had a wide release later in that year, on October 12th, 2001. The only Oscar nomination this movie had was for its Best Director, but it was nominated for Best Dramatic Film, Director, Screenplay, and Best Original Score at the Golden Globes, though it was shut out of all four. The only major award win it has to its name was the 2002 BAFTA for Best Editing. So, a revered film, but not an award-winning film. 8.0 on IMDb, tying it for 215th place in the IMDb Top 250. Like I said, it's one of my personal favorites, if not the number one overall. I think it's an A movie, and I'll give you a little personal background. The first time I saw this movie, I was like 15, 16.
Ooh.
I was watching it alone.
Scarred for life.
My parents walked in at like the middle of the third act when the old people are coming out of the paper bag at the end. They asked me what the hell was going on. I was furious because I had no idea what was happening. I had no grasp. I hated this movie.
You don't have a temper, though.
Cut to 6 or 7 years later, I rewatched it for only the second time because I was frustrated not knowing what was going on.
Right.
I received such highly critical reviews. There's a website out there called birthmoviesdeath.com. There's an article that says Hulk's take on Mulholland Drive.
Which is an absurd sentence.
It's absurd.
You have to explain that.
But it
Hulk
fits,
is the persona.
It fits perfectly
of
to
the
understand
blogger.
This movie.
Yeah, he's
yeah,
a
this
blogger.
Guy takes the persona of the Hulk and he explains it, everything through a third person perspective of the Hulk says this, the Hulk says that. It's like having The Rock tell you a bedtime story. But if you read that article, birthmoviesdeath.com, it's the Hulk's take on Mulholland Drive. I read that article simultaneously while watching the movie to get his kind of take on it. It makes you understand the movie, at least made me understand the movie so much clearer and so much better. It gave me such a better picture of what Lynch was going for. I've kind of adopted the Hulk's perspective on this movie as
agree.
To my own.
Because I went at Salon.com, Esquire.com, Huffington Post, Roger Ebert. None of them had none of them were as made as much sense as this take on it. So yeah, I agree.
And it's completely important. Random. I literally just typed it into Google to like somebody help me with Mulholland Drive, and I came up with this. I've adopted that perspective, a lot of it. There's some things we disagree on, but a lot of what I'm going to tell you is my interpretation of the film comes from him. So
right.
I want to give him all the credit in the world. I don't know when that was written. I don't know who that guy is, obviously, because he just goes by the Hulk. But birthmoviesdeath.com. Thank you, whoever you are, for writing that. Whoever the Hulk is, God bless you, giant green man.
Look forward to seeing your movie this fall.
Let's get into the plot.
That was like a Frodo Gandalf joke there. I'm sorry, folks. I apologize. It's not that funny. This is a movie about suicide.
And gunshot. we start with a big, you know, David Lynch is this big swing doo-wop hairpiece guy. And that's how we start. We start with this big doo-wop.
Weirdest opening
yeah.
shot.
And couples dancing, swing dancing.
There's you could say WTF. After every single one of your notes and
this is
on these
why
movies,
I don't want to go into scene things. By scene by this movie, especially because if I explain to you scene by scene, if you've never seen this movie, you are not going to understand a fucking thing.
Yeah, here's
about.
The thing: I'm like, this is a kind of the juicy review, a little inside baseball here for people who love this movie that have read like Esquire instead of Hulk.
Losers!
This is the deep dive you've been waiting for because I think we got at least we have a take. You know, that's obviously based on our
we can walk you through what we think
our Jolly Green Giant. Yeah, yeah, no, we think we got it here. We're confident. Yeah. We have a rational confidence.
You should stop listening now. No, not joking. I'm self-deprecating.
Confidence.
No, I think we have a take. Again, thank you, birthmoviestep.com, for the most part. So we start with that big doo-wop opening. There's 1950s girls and guys dressed up in the 1950s clothing, the pencil skirts and all that, doing spring dancing. We then see Naomi Watts joined at the side by two older people. Looks like she's accepting an award of some kind or being showered with praise, waving to the
parents,
audience.
Metaphor for her past.
And then we're in first-person perspective as we go down into a pillow. The screen goes dark.
That's a much more important shot than we ever thought.
And it's such a throwaway scene.
Upon rewatch, that zoom into the goddamn pillow, that pink reddish pillow.
Yep.
My goodness! And it's man, he makes it red to try and tell us that it's important.
Yeah.
And we watch it before, and we watch it again, and we watch it four more times,
but
maybe
just,
my seventh rewatch.
It's just the second scene that doesn't make any sense, right? Like, if you're watching this with no perspective, it's just another scene that doesn't make any fucking sense.
But that's the tell-all shot right there. I would agree. You know, just zoom in on the goddamn red pillow.
And then go to dark. It's as simple as that. And, you know, we're led to Mulholland Drive from there. Laura Herring character is dressed up. She's in the backseat of a car being driven somewhere. We see the Mulholland Drive street sign. That's when her driver and the people in the front seat turn to her, turn the gun on her. They tell her to get out. They're trying to rob her. Before that happens, a teenage wild car driven by these wild teenagers comes down Mulholland Drive, causes this huge T-bone accident with that car. Laura Herring's character somehow survives. We see her looking over the city of what we think looks like Hollywood. She ends up going down, finding this empty apartment, or this apartment that will be empty once the aunt character leaves for good, which she's on her way out.
Mm-hmm.
Laura Herring's character goes into that apartment to get herself situated. We are then met with Naomi Watts' character coming off a plane. We see the two old people next to her that turn into giving up the creepiest smile in movie history.
Oh, my God. That scene with those and the old lady's smile might be creepy. Who's creepier?
No, it's the old
For
lady.
Me, it's the old lady.
It's the old lady.
Yeah.
I mean, the old guy looks like he's acting, trying to have a creepy smile. That old lady's given that smile before. She has creeped out children with that smile before.
She scares me to the end of my life.
That was far scarier than anything that happened with the face in Lord of the Rings. So Naomi Watts is on her way to the same apartment because that's her aunt's apartment. She gets in there. She meets Laura Herring's character. Laura Herring character has amnesia of some sort, has no idea who she is. Naomi Watts is this well-to-do, diamonds in her eyes, hope against the world, hopeful actress. Naomi Watts is, we learned, is called Betty Elms. She gives Laura Herring's character the Rita name.
Right.
Based off a Rita Hayworth poster. So we have Betty and Rita, and they're going to try to find out who Rita really is. They think she might be this woman named Diane Selwyn. All this is done in between Betty going to these auditions for these big roles in Hollywood because she's achieving her dreams.
Yeah, so they become fast friends, which is bizarre because you have car accident girl with amnesia, stows away in some random apartment where your quote-unquote protagonist is moving into, and it's familiar enough to the old chestnut of kind of an amnesiac story.
Right.
However, and it's totally bizarre, but he makes it so believable.
Mm-hmm. And that's what you think you're watching.
You know, for somebody as unconventional as this, to take a kind of Tarantino-style, you know, old nugget of old chestnut story and have it go off the rails and then still bring it home as convincing is amazing.
So from there, we have a couple subplots that unwind. Betty Elms goes and meets Adam Keschler, who's this big Hollywood director at some point, who himself is casting this movie. He wants to have his leading actress has gone missing, and he is told by the studio to hire Camilla Rhodes. Adam Keschler is played by Justin Theroux of Leftovers fame and Jennifer Aniston's husband's fame. He disagrees with the studio. He wants to cast his own movie. The studio threatens to give him problems. All these weird, disconnected things are happening. Like we see,
in unfamiliar orders.
Yeah, I mean, the man behind the counter, the guy that's pulling the strings of the studio and everything, is the little person from Twin Peaks.
Yes,
who's making calls to Adam Keschler's people. It's so fucking bizarre, and you think if you watch this with no pretense, you're like, what the fuck am I watching?
So, we're going to sort it out for you folks.
Hopefully.
And I think Mike has done a lot for me to in terms of forming my understanding on this, so let me take the baton.
Go ahead.
I think
it's your time, Padawan.
Yeah, I mean, you have the Rita and Betty story of two unlikely friends. She's taking in the stray cat, trying to help this woman out, you know, naive in a new city. I'm not going to say the word yet. Yes, I am. Fantasy. Like her fantasy of becoming friends with quotation marks first with this woman. That story of her uncovering who she really is. Then you have three subplots. Number one, you have the subplot with the film director, Justin Theroux. Now,
that's the Adam Kessler character.
The nefarious evil forces circling a movie production are shown in full force, and they're shown at all different times.
And they're the studio.
The studio has just an...
It's not the director's
impossible
vision.
To please guy with the who wants the perfect espresso.
It's a funny scene.
You have atop the Hollywood late night, whatever the hell, the cowboy.
I have no idea who he is in the story,
directing,
by the way.
Who is directing the studio somehow. Anyway, he's the bag man who tells Justin Theroux in the middle of the night that he's supposed to cast this certain actress to play the film. And you have all the people in the Red Room from the Twin Peaks Red Room, you know, the devil and his whatever, the whatever you want to call them in terms of their metaphor, influencing, making calls throughout this story to get a certain actress cast. Now, you also have kind of a side plot, C story, if you will, of this hitman who works or has meetings at a diner. But the hitman, this blonde hitman, has this insane scene. One of the better...
It's like Coen Brothers-esque.
Coen Brothers-style scenes. Again, take off the rails, Tarantino-style scene. I mean, maybe Tarantino does Lynchian style scenes, yeah, because this one is so good. It's horrifying, and it's dark, as gallows humor funny as it gets, where he accidentally shoots some people, but having this ridiculous conversation with the guy about the car crash,
mm-hmm.
making fun of it. So the segue's there, and then he shoots the guy, and whoops, there's somebody else alive in here. I better shoot them too. Whoops. I didn't kill him.
Effect.
I didn't kill him, so I got to go after another one. So I'm trying to, even though we're spoiling big picture stuff, I'm trying not to spoil your enjoyment of the scene or rewatching of the scene. Comedy of errors scene. Mm-hmm. You have a comedy of errors hitman
scene.
It's
your comic relief
in the middle of this movie, which is just...
Which is purposeful, because the hitman is portrayed as a clumsy idiot.
Right.
And you'll find out why in a second.
And finally, I would say the diner subplot is the last one, where you have, I don't know if it's a producer and a writer or if it's a patient and his therapist.
I think it's just the patient and his therapist, I think.
I took it as producer and writer, but he tells his friend, this guy in the diner tells his friend about a dream he just had. And it's a scary as hell dream. And then the guy goes to pay for their meal and the dream comes true.
Yes. Immediately.
In that scene. And again, I don't want to spoil within the scene, but it's one of the freakiest,
it's disturbing.
Craziest
it's disturbing.
Moments you'll ever have watching a movie.
Okay. Here's the rub. The first 2 hours, and this is almost the verbatim line in the article, too, so I'm really trying not to plagiarize with my words, but...
You are.
Yeah, I am. You need to read this article. Birthmoviesdeath.com. Please seek it out. The first 2 hours of Mulholland Drive is a dream. Mm-hmm. The Betty Elms character, the Naomi Watts character, in real life, not in the dream state, mm-hmm. has had a falling out in this relationship with her girlfriend, Camilla Rhodes.
Right.
Camilla Rhodes is the Laura Herring character, who's in real life gone on to be this famous, relatively famous actress. She said big things. And she has left Diane Selwyn, which is Naomi Watts' character's real name.
Yes.
Not in the dream. The dream, Naomi Watts is Betty. Real life, Diane Selwyn is Naomi Watts, who has turned into this bitter, vindictive woman, is angry that Laura Herring's character in real life has left her for Adam Kessler,
the director.
Who's the director,
Justin
Theroux. So she, Diane Selwyn, yes. Naomi Watts' character in real life, trying to hit you over the head with that so you follow.
Illustrated by the final scenes of the movie, yep.
She hires the blonde hitman, who in her dream is a bumbling idiot, in real life is not. She hires the blonde hitman to kill Laura Herring's character.
Right.
the dream is the manifestation of guilt and deniability that Diane Selwyn in real life has.
Right.
She, in her dream state, has become this Betty Elms, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed Hollywood underachiever. She is going through, she thinks she's this great actress that hasn't been discovered yet. That's why she nails her fucking audition.
In her dream.
You know, she's beloved by the casting director. She wants to be immediately, the Justin Theroux director
falls in love with her instantly. Yes. And he's forced by all these nefarious overlords to cast somebody else. Not because she's not good enough.
She's forced to cast Camilla Rhodes. Because Camilla Rhodes, in Diane Selwyn's dream, has become everything bad about the real Camilla Rhodes. Whereas the Laura Herring's character, Laura Herring in the dream has become Rita. Diane Selwyn, the Naomi Watts real life character, is dreaming about all the good parts of the real life Camilla Rhodes, who's her ex-girlfriend, and has turned them into Rita. Yes. So Rita is the good parts of the Camilla Rhodes real life person.
And ingeniously, in her quote unquote dream fantasy, whatever, she's taking the final moment of reality, the death of this person in reality, as the daydreamed up, concocted in her own mind scenario that she comes to the rescue of.
Right.
So this woman died in a car crash, which, again, another clue for this whole explanation is that David Lynch dedicated this movie to an actress who died in a car crash. From one of his other movies, Lost Highway. Anyway, the quote-unquote Rita Camilla character, the Rita part of their character, is the end of Camilla's life. The dream Rita takes off as if, you know, she could rectify that situation in her fantasy.
She feels bad about having her killed.
Again, so manifestation of grit.
And that's and Lynch portrays this as a rebirth of the Rita character. She comes out totally nude. The first time Diane meets her, she's coming out of the shower. She's wet as if she had just been born.
Yep.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of symbolism there, which Lynch is into.
Is he?
I couldn't tell. So that's where the big main storyline is. The lesser extent is that everyone that the real Diane Selwyn has encountered is in this dream. For example, Naomi Watts Diane Selwyn dates after Camilla Rhodes in real life. She ends up dating this other woman who's kind of like a neighbor, lives nearby or something like that. We see her in the last third of the movie. She comes back for her lamp or some other shit.
Yes.
From Diane's apartment. That woman is manifested in the dream as the quote-unquote Diane Selwyn's neighbor.
Right.
She makes an appearance because everybody that Diane Selwyn in real life has seen is seen in this dream.
Made a character.
So that her real-life ex-girlfriend that's after Camilla becomes the neighbor of the Diane Selwyn character in the dream. The Diane Selwyn character in the dream has become this awful, deceased, rotting corpse of a human being.
Rough look.
It's a tough scene to get through. Mm-hmm. But Rita and Betty find Diane Selwyn in the dream world. She's this drug-addled, wasting away to nothing, basically useless character. And she's a corpse. She's dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's because in Diane's own mind, what she did is unforgivable, and she's as good as dead.
Right.
Everything from that point is symbolism. Everything in this movie is symbolism. It's a backwards, it was all a dream movie.
Repurposing the narrative of her own life. Whether you characterize it as quote unquote her dream before she finishes the story, whether you characterize it as, you know, a combination of, I mean, and again, transcendental meditation doesn't necessarily draw lines between daydreams, fantasy, you know, Zen, actual dream, you know, they kind of group that, all that stuff is in a similar vein where you could say that this is a life before flashing before your eyes story. You could say that this is all a dream story, but you can frame it in a couple different ways. It doesn't matter is what I'm saying.
True.
It's a fantasy. It's an unreality reality.
Now here's where Lynch kind of earns his money with me is that, okay, it's creative enough that it's a backwards, it was all a dream, or it's this is your life type story. Mm-hmm. It's creative enough that you have to figure out that everyone in her real life ends up in the dream. Those are creative enough. What Lynch, I think, earns his money is that he takes the idea that reality is a character in the dream. he uses certain people in the dream as the idea of reality trying to wake Naomi Watts up from this dream.
Yes.
And encounter what she has done in real life.
Yes. The reality is the antagonism.
Right. Yeah, that's the perfect way of saying it.
Yes.
I mean, there's a character that comes to the door when Diane and Rita are first talking about it, and she's this fortune teller character, and Diane saying, you know, our Naomi Watts' character is introducing herself as Betty, and the character saying, that's not your name, that's not your name, and the tone, there's a big tonal shift, it gets real dark and heavy. That's reality literally trying to wake Naomi Watts up.
Something that just dawned on me, the quote-unquote, what you would think is antagonism against her character of Betty in the early ongoing, the nefarious, all the forces playing against her in regards to the casting process. The fact that she's stuck in this ridiculous, weird scenario with this amnesiac, just, I don't know, squatter. All those things should be antagonistic, correct? The fact that she's literally flashing to, and this is in her dream, to all the backstory of characters that have something to do with this world, like the director, mm-hmm. like the person at the diner, like all the trying to give it backstory, give her fantasy the backstory it needs. All that, quote unquote, on the surface antagonism actually fuels some of the bigger payoffs and bigger, you know, fantastic. Well, it kind of fuels her fantasies. Like after these things happen, the best, you know, her dreams come true. Literally, in the dream,
right.
She gets to have sex with the woman she loves.
She's
in
able
the dream,
to, yeah.
She gets the director's attention and wants to be cast. In the dream, she has the perfect audition. In the dream, all the things go right for her. So that's why, again, it's not just necessarily a nightmare. You can't just categorize this as a nightmare. I don't think David Lynch makes the distinction. This is very much a character study and a strict POV. That he literally tells the story through her addled mind.
I mean, think about yourself too, right? Like, mm-hmm. in your own mind, in all our own minds, we're the stars of our own movies.
This plot line reads like a writer's first draft for a failed romance novel.
That's fair.
No offense, but sometimes, you know, you write nonsense in your first drafts of your stories and you reread it and it's like, what the hell? This is like, obviously, it doesn't take Freud to analyze this. my stuff reads like crap. It reads like just overt, you know, fan fiction fantasy. It doesn't work. This plot line plays like that, and he hits every note of a fantasy.
It's if you watch it too in-depthly,
this is more of a fantasy than Lord of the Rings.
You're going to end up looking at yourself in the mirror, and you're not going to like what you say.
But what seems quote-unquote random or just because he wants to screw with you
is very much based in her
point of view.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point that you think there's some random stuff, and there's just not. Everything has a purpose and a point. But the larger point that I was trying to make is that you're your own movie star in your head. In your head, what anxiety, at least to me, is that you think other people are obsessed with you as you are. You know, like you think people are judging you. You think people are looking at you. You think people. So this is what she's doing in this dream. She's making everyone think about her, whether
like
she's in the scene or not.
Manic depression, the movie. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not smart enough. I don't want to categorize bipolar or manic depressives. I don't want to do that. I don't want to die on that hill. But for mental illness, this is mental illness personified.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. So we have the whole dream sequence. We have the Rita character being born anew, relying on the Betty Elms character, which is all Diane Selwyn's manifestation in her mind and her dream state.
Right.
We have reality trying to pull her out. We have the storyline with Justin Theroux's director character kind of getting shit on because in Diane's mind.
Can we say something about those scenes, too? Those are ridiculous.
Oh, they're hilarious. They're
ridiculously great.
Billy Ray Cyrus is a badass in this
Billy
movie.
Billy Ray Cyrus is the guy who's cuckolding, you know, Justin Theroux's character, who's sleeping with Justin Theroux's wife when Justin Theroux comes home in the middle of the day and then pours a pink barrel, what do they call it, pail of paint in her jewelry box and he gets into a fight with the guy and then he has a scene where a mafia hitman who's a huge guy, come barrels in and gives another scene where the woman tries to beat him up, where the guy tries to beat him up, and where the mafia hitman just knocks him away like him.
Flies.
Yeah, so I did have a question about that for you in terms of where that fits in. However, I understand that it's kind of the 1-2-3 beginning, middle, end of that subplot.
And it's bad things need to happen to her because need to happen to Justin Theroux's character because Diane says thinks he's responsible for taking the real life.
So yeah, so okay, that answers my question. So essentially, Betty, Diane's mind is making the beginning, middle, end of that fantasy character's life feed into the backstory of what's going on.
In the dream, she's playing God, and this is her perfect world, and this is what would happen to all these characters in Diane Selwyn's perfect world.
Rationalizing what's really happened to her.
Trying to avoid it.
In her fantasy.
Trying to avoid it.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, Justin Theroux, again, takes Camilla Rhodes' real life away from Diane, or Camilla Rhodes falls in love with Justin Theroux's character.
Yes.
And so in the dream state, Diane's dream state, Justin Theroux's character is nothing more than a throwaway that bad things happen to, because he's an asshole.
But here's what's amazing. And I think this is going to start to segue into the finale of what we're going to talk about. Here's what's amazing. Just like a dream, she's withheld the ultimate payoff. Her dream character of Betty, she doesn't get to go on the roller coaster in her dream. She doesn't get to eat the meal that she's preparing in her dream. She gets to have sex with her, but that's more memory than dream. And again, lines are all...
And maybe she doesn't even have sex with her. Maybe they just kiss and it's a screen cut.
After Silencio, you're going to get into Silencio.
Greatest fucking scene.
After Silencio, where they're just starting to figure out what's happening, that's when you go into get sucked into the blue box.
So, one of the more creepy scenes of the movie, Diane and Rita are laying in bed. Rita has gone through this whole makeover because there's a lot of theories as to why. They're trying to hide her from the mob. They're trying to hide her from the directorial process. They're trying to hide her from some evil.
I just want to say, before Silencio, I've reconstructed this for you because you've sold me. The scene leading up to Silencio is my worst scene of the movie, where Rita, who again validates my opinion.
I haven't figured out why it is as it is.
She's a terrible actress. She's smoking. She's a smoke show, but she's a terrible...
Cancel Laura Herring?
Yeah. She's a terrible actress. She just wakes up and does this soap opera, you know.
I think it's just the clock. I think Diane has been asleep for 8 hours, and I think it's time to wake up. And I think waking up is... So here's the scene Mike's talking about, is that they're both in bed. They had just made love. And then in the middle of the night, seemingly... the Rita character wakes up, her eyes get wide, and she just starts speaking Spanish.
Right.
Or some dead language, other dead language, and it doesn't make any sense, and then she just starts saying Silencio, Silencio, Silencio.
Right. Fuck. So basically she's getting a premonition in the dream to take Betty to the club, the midnight opera.
Which to me, I think is signaling that it's just time for Diane to wake up, but that's, we'll get into that.
Right.
We go to a club from there, in the middle of the night, mind you, mm-hmm. Betty and Rita go to a club named Silencio.
And this is after, by the way, to give folks, you know, this is after all their sleuthing. They've done like a sleuth. They're on the path to figuring out who Rita is.
Right.
They went back to Diane Selwyn's apartment. So they're getting warmer and warmer and warmer.
Right. This is what's basically taking us into the end of the movie.
And in their success, they have sex with each other and then they wake up.
As you do. Right. So they go to the club named Silencio. The whole point of Silencio is that you hear "No I Banda, No I Banda, No I Banda," which means the band is not real. The band is not there. The whole point of Silencio is what they're saying is what you're seeing is not there. It's not real, which is not only a metaphor for the stage, because you have a trumpet player that's not actually playing the trumpet when you think he is. You have a singer that's not actually singing when you think she is.
Yes.
It's not there. Nothing is there, which is telling Diane, this is a dream. Nothing of this is real. Nothing is actually there. There's no band. There's no person. There's no Rita. There's just you in reality. So Diane has kind of accepted in her subconscious that, oh, this is real. So all that's left to accept is to get out of the Rita thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Betty at this point has departed. Rita is by herself in the apartment. We have been told that she has a blue key in her purse. One of the only things that it's kind of one of the secrets they're trying to track down. The blue key fits this random blue box.
Yeah, it's the MacGuffin of the dream.
Yeah, it's just she waking up.
Solves the MacGuffin problem of the dream. Whether you call it Pandora's box or whatnot, in her mind, they realize that this box is, you know, the creature behind the diner's possession earlier in her fantasy. And yeah, she gets sucked in, or the Rita character gets sucked into the box.
And then we're in reality. And from there, we're dealing with Diane's, Naomi Watts' Diane Selwyn character.
Reality with,
quote unquote,
question, yeah, with quotation marks.
Big time. She's having intermittent flashbacks, so it's no longer a dream state, but it is what actually happened between her and the real Camilla Rhodes.
What's so cool about this story structure is that in the first two-thirds of the film, it's her fantasy going up against reality. So the reality is the antagonism. Now, in the last third of the movie, it's her reality is going against, obviously, the forces of hallucination and her craziness, her illness, if I use a better word. Just, again, David Lynch flipping the plot on its head.
Which is this, I mean, that's a sentence, but it's a story for the whole movie. I mean, it's just a backwards movie. I don't want to, you're into some visualization at the end, you got some other things that are left open to interpretation. I don't want to go all the way in saying, I know we said this is a spoiler full, but I don't want to, you know, if you want to watch the movie, I don't think it's necessary to tell you in this podcast exactly what happens to the Diane character.
I don't know, though, because this is kind of the balls of this movie. I'm gonna sabotage you in saying that, because I think,
all right, go for
this
it.
This movie is about, damn it, don't pound your fist, it gets into the, this movie is about getting inside the mind of somebody who's suicidal and mentally ill.
Yes.
So they have to follow through on that.
Yes.
And have her kill herself. So this is perhaps,
but
one of the more courageous. One of the more courageous filmmaking endeavors ever, because he's trying to get inside the mind. He is searching to get inside the mind of this tragedy, of this human tragedy that is, whether it's his friend who killed themselves, whether it's whatever, the impulse everybody has to fight at some point if you're a starving artist, or
just, it's proving that even in the most escape, like even using the most escapism, there's no escaping reality.
Yes.
Right? Like, you got to deal.
But there are clues within this movie. Like, we talked about before, Peg Entwistle was the one of the more famous suicides in Hollywood history. In the 40s, I think, she jumped off the H in the Hollywood sign, influenced the 1950 movies that influenced David Lynch. Mm-hmm. You have the car crash and a dedication to Loretta Syme, an actress who played a small part in Lost Highway, like I said. These clues give a lot of weight to the climax of the film. Now, the climax, it's not a victory for Diane Selwyn. She goes down and down hard. You know, the crying masturbation scene?
Oh, my God.
After the fantasy of the final sex scene with
There's
Rita,
so many fucking things that make your skin
crawl. I think
crawl.
That goes into the real dinner, which she's, again, you know, whether it's life flashing before her eyes or she's thinking back to it all in her craziness before she ends it all, it's definitely a progression that works with the conventions of story structure, but on the flip side of a hero's journey, it's a tragedy. Now, it's amazing that a story about a suicide is nominated. I will say that right out of the gate here. Christ almighty. But it's also a triumph in the sense that he knows you can't just tell a story about a suicide, otherwise it's going to be as marketable as Christine was, right? I mean, make no money. He goes, for me, what's admirable about this, he's trying to understand this story, and this is how he makes sense of it. And he dives full bore into the mental illness factor. And there's manifestations of the mental illness in her fantasy at every step of the way. He takes such precious control of all these elements in his story, all the surrealism of the story. So that's the heaviness of this plot line. So the spoiler alert of all spoiler alerts is, in my opinion, this movie is about a suicide.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly... Ooh. It's certainly leading up to that, and you know, it's clearly about a troubled woman, whether she has a diagnosed mental illness or whether it's just, you know, it's a person's take on a grieving over a relationship that she thought was real, it's certainly heavy. I mean, it's huge. And it's funny seeing the way tricks of the mind are dealt with in a movie like this as compared to something like A Beautiful Mind, where you're given, you know, everything has an underlying level of hope in A Beautiful Mind. In this one, you're kind of hoping against hope. You know what's going to happen if you watch it. Like, you know there's only one way out.
He telegraphs it, no question about it. So that's why I wonder, you know, again, I don't think it matters if it's a, you know, exactly what the flashback of the first two acts is. If it's a dream, if it's a mix between dream, daydream,
I think it's pretty fantasy. Obvious that it's a dream, though. I mean, from the pillow shot, and then she's waking up in bed.
I would agree, but I don't think... I think it's... I've never had a dream that well structured.
A lucid structured. Dream? You never had a lucid dream where you can control the... what's going
not
on?
Not to a T. And I don't think... You know, reading the little that I have about transcendentalism, I don't think they believe that, obviously, you know, you're going to have a hero's journey, perfectly structured dream, even in a lucid dream. So, I don't think for them they necessarily want to draw these distinctions between. It's just the dream state is all being thrown into that side of the story.
Yeah, for sure.
Whatever you want to call it.
I mean,
if you want to call it a dream, that's fine.
You're left with 2 hours of a dream and 20 minutes of real life.
If it's just quote unquote meditation on her former life and her explanation and rationalization for what she's about to do, that's what I believe it is.
So, watch this movie.
Effect.
Watch this movie.
Yeah, I mean,
listen to this first if you have to, but watch this movie.
But it's as heavy as it gets. So,
best scene,
just in terms of pure cinema, is the diner scene upon rewatch for me. Is the diner scene between the producer? It's the C plot. It kind of encapsulates the diner.
Turns out to be more important than you think, too.
Yeah, I mean, the C plot is the device that is going to propel you into Act 3 of this story.
Yeah, you're wrong. It's Silencio.
No, but the C plot.
No, I mean for the best scene.
Pandora's
you're wrong.
Box.
Yeah,
no,
it's Silencio.
Structurally, I'm right. I'm never wrong.
No, I was my best scene is the Silencio scene. I actually have it in my notes. I've showed my.
I've gained
the greatest scene of movie history. It's so good.
An appreciation of it. Yes.
Worst scene.
The pre-Silencio scene, like I mentioned.
Yeah.
Worst scene for you.
Did bring that up.
Yeah.
Man, can I have a worse scene in my favorite movie?
Crying masturbation?
Just because that's like... so skin crawling. I will say there's some imagery where I don't know if it's that I don't understand it or more so that I don't agree with it, but like the guy behind the diner at the end, you know, do you have to have the old people crawling out for one last, you know, F you to the viewer crawling out of the paper bag? I get it. It's that, you know, there is no real happiness where she is. And there's no feelings of warmth and good company, you know?
It's a feeling that overwhelms Naomi Watts at the end, right? It's the feeling of failure.
That's great performance by her in this whole movie.
Right. She's absurdly good. How she doesn't win makes me wonder about things. But again, you know, I don't know if it stands up, the special effects. I don't know if these actors... or anybody that mean anything. I don't know if they're good enough, but yeah, I mean, little tiny people, it just shows you the kind of the ridiculousness of it all.
And it
might be one of those things that doesn't work, but yeah, I mean, you have to personify that force because you can't just have her, you know, the subtext of the scene force her to get on the bed and shoot herself. You have to have somebody force her to do it.
Yeah, I did. Watch this movie, guys.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry we kind of took our foot off the joking and the funny, but we're dealing with such a serious subject
as
suicide.
Deep dive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But these were, you know, like we said, we framed the whole episode like this is perfecting perfection. We think these two movies, directorially especially, are head and shoulders above the other three. As far as perfecting perfection, finishing it off, what was your number two and what was your number one?
It's close, you know, and I have the enormous respect for both movies. They're both, for me, 94-95 A's, slam dunk A's.
Yeah, I have 94-96 myself.
I just have, you know, again, Lord of the Rings has its distractions. I have my problems with it, but I do rate it a tick above, and it's one of my favorite movies of all time, so it's not like, but it's there for me at number one. And Mulholland Drive is... especially after rewatching Twin Peaks: The Return, which is just throwing me through loops. But here's the thing. I've watched it once. I'm in the middle of it. right now as the time of when we're podcasting. Maybe by the end of it, I'll probably have a whole new thing. Just you like won't. You had. No, I'm going to have a whole new review of it.
You'll be confused.
Well, after I watch it, it's going to be a hard series to rewatch a bunch of times because it is long-form David Lynch. And yeah. Long-form David Lynch. Like, here's the thing. David Lynch crammed into 2 hours or an hour and 45 is bite-sized enough to deal with.
Right.
And rewatchable right. enough. So, yeah, I mean, it's short-form David Lynch is my preference.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And to get to my whole point of that rambling is that I have restored faith in David Lynch by rewatching this movie.
I would like to see him come out with another Mulholland Drive-esque movie at some point. I think with the updates in film and what it is in cinematography.
I doubt it. I think this is a victory lap for him.
I agree. I don't think he's doing anything.
Everybody he's ever worked with is palling around with him on this Twin Peaks of Return. I think that's it.
I have the same ranking as you, although I think Mulholland Drive is the better movie. That's just personal preference. But
you vote Best Director? So you would have voted Best Picture Mulholland Drive?
Yeah,
Best Director?
I would have. The balls, both guys had balls in putting out what they did. But the balls in Peter Jackson to get away with what he did. And again, it when you have a movie that so obviously changes movie history.
Yes.
And from everything going forward, it changed the way blockbusters were viewed. It changed the way awards viewed blockbusters. It changed the way they were shot, et cetera, et cetera. Lord of the Rings, I think, was number one. And I don't know, as close as it was, and it was very close, and that's why these two films are so much better than the other three, I think.
So, to bring this full circle in terms of the Mike, and Oscar perspective, I was thinking a lot about this. If Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring wins, it doesn't change much, does it? Because, and maybe it does, but Star Wars was going to reshape blockbuster.
As far as movie history, you're saying it doesn't?
Movie history, regardless.
I agree.
Lord of the Rings was going to reshape it regardless because it launched the franchise, especially the expanded universe franchise, all right, type of blockbuster filmmaking. If Mulholland Drive wins Best Picture based upon...
LSD becomes legal.
Yeah. What does that do for
movie history? $10,000 question, right? I mean, who knows? Do we get more transcendental pictures? Is more bigger budgets go towards art house pictures?
Yeah, I mean, I think, if you look at the woulda, coulda, shouldas that we've discussed already a little bit and that we'll continue to discuss, like what if Do the Right Thing? What if Pulp Fiction won? What if Do the Right Thing was nominated, for Christ's sake?
Yeah, ridiculous.
If those movies won, would Hollywood been put under pressure to conform to these new school ways of doing things that we think are
it's a great
cutting
question.
Edge and better.
It's a great question.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, Mulholland, I don't know if there's another filmmaker who's dared to get this way. Maybe he's years ahead of his time. Maybe it's a kindness that he's dealing with such a ridiculously difficult subject matter in this way. And that's how I'm going to take David Lynch in Mulholland Drive. Like, here he's characterizing an impossible subject matter, suicide. He's dealing with these themes, whether it's the whole shebang, like I'm saying, or whether it's a part of it. He is going through all this trouble and artistry to tell that story. When it comes down to tell a story that's based on something horrific, he's jumping through hoops to do that for you. Would people in Hollywood have been more ballsy and instead of the cookie cutter biopic that deals with mental illness in its way, would they just go and
artiste? Balls out.
Yeah, go balls out.
Interpretation films. Yeah. I mean, it's, that's an alternate timeline, right? Like, we could have gone that way, but that's again, we hit it with a hammer almost every episode, but the Academy plays it safe. And Ron Howard won Best Director, and A Beautiful Mind won Best Picture. That was what's going to happen.
I mean, at the time, I would love to see the votes. I wish they would.
Yeah, I wish they would do it for all of them.
At some point. Even if they would get so much publicity if they just released the votes for all these movies. And maybe that's we got to bang
like
the
Faye
table.
Dunaway
that is the mission of this podcast. We are going to get the Academy to release the votes.
How did La La Land win Best Picture?
How's everybody not super curious, right?
No, I'm with you. I'm totally
because
with you.
Because I'm super curious about what the Academy thought back then. If nobody got this movie until 10 years later.
Right.
Except for, a handful of people just enough to nominate it. But if it was just enough to nominate it,
then more word of spread.
You would think enough people got it at the time. It took us 20 years. 16 years.
And the help of a superhero. Another retrospective in the books for you. 2001 Best Director. All wrapped up nice in a neat package there. Pretty much as efficiently as David Lynch explained the meaning behind Mulholland Drive, right? Yeah, you guys all knew it. Yeah, that's what the Filmy Feud episode is going to look like. We don't have another one picked out yet, but I'm sure it's going to pop up again. We wanted to give this one to you guys as a little taste of the various kinds of episodes or sagas that you're going to be seeing from us in the future. Listen to us every week. At least going to give you at least one episode a week. We try to do more than that, but Mike, and Oscar, you know where to get at us. Otherwise, like I said at the top of the show, we are on Instagram, Mike, and Oscar. We are on Facebook at Mike, and Oscar. We are on Twitter at MMO_pod. We are at Gmail at MikeMikeAndOscar@gmail.com. Want to hear your comments, thoughts, submissions. Leave us a post, leave us a text, leave us something. We'll try to get back to you, try to respond to everyone we have, or at least read them on air. Something to that effect. But we hope you enjoyed this Filmly Feud take. You know, what do you guys think? Do you think one of the other three that we mentioned are better than Lord of the Rings or Mulholland Drive? Do you think that we were wrong in picking these two for the Filmly Feud? Do you think we preferred Mulholland Drive or Lord of the Rings over one of the other? Was Mike right? Was I wrong? Were we both wrong in our rankings at the end? That's for you guys to tell us. That's what we do this. We love hearing you guys' feedback, and we love putting things out there for you guys to debate over yourselves, between yourselves. So until next week, until next time. Guys, as you know, reality sucks. Watch movies with us. We'll see you Monday. Well, Wednesday? Wednesday. Yeah, we'll see you Wednesday, day before Thanksgiving. I know my days of the week. See you Wednesday, day before Thanksgiving. Netflix year in review. Later, guys.